I'd like to welcome everybody back for another version of my podcast, which is an opportunity for me to have conversations with friends, colleagues, educators, leaders, innovators. In this podcast version, talking to an old friend, a college roommate, but more significantly, he's an attorney with Lewis Rocha Rothberger Christie in the Religious Institutions Practice Group. Eric Niffen practices his focus on religious liberty cases in the trial and appellate levels, as well as commercial litigation matters. He's represented clients in high-profile religious liberty cases, including nationwide litigation challenging the HHS mandate, and has successfully represented the United States in 3 cases before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Eric, let me just jump right in and get a sense of where we stand, and thanks for spending this time with us. But could you give me an overview of where we stand from a national perspective in regards to religious liberty as we head into 2018?
Sure, Eric. Thanks for inviting me on. This is fun. So I think the best place to start is where I and other people who really care about religious liberty were, you know, a little over a year ago, thinking that, you know, here we were at the end of 8 years of the Obama presidency and looking at what I certainly thought and, you know, most people thought was going to be a Hillary Clinton victory. And that was a really scary time. There was a lot. Obama, whatever else you want to say about him, was enormously effective at changing the culture and changing people's expectations, and not really so much through legislation, but through regulatory actions and through his own rhetoric, really reshaping a lot of the government and legal pressures on religious institutions, and was remarkably effective in that regard. So when Trump was elected, it was a real surprise and a real respite, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, we were going to have, you know, some more breathing room and another day to fight. The biggest thing that Trump has done is appoint good judges. And the second thing he's done is appoint good people. I think it's really important. I heard this a lot when I lived in Washington, and I think it's really true that when you elect a president, you don't elect a president, you elect this huge apparatus. And so that, you know, we don't have to talk here about Trump's personal qualities and his virtues and his vices, but he's appointed really good people, and the people that he's working with to select judges. These are not, nobody's under the impression that Trump himself is sitting down with resumes and deciding who's well suited to be a federal judge, but he's outsourced that to other people who are really good people. And the same thing, as you mentioned, I've been involved now for over 7 years in litigating against the HHS contraception mandate, something that was passed as a regulation under the Affordable Care Act. And HHS is where a lot of the most frightening attacks on religious liberty have been happening. And if you look today, there are an amazing number of really strong pro-life people, really good people who are in HHS. And so those things have really changed the landscape in important ways for all sorts of religious employers. It isn't just people in the healthcare field, but healthcare, you know, touches everything. So that's really important. But at the same time, I think what we've seen is a real shift in where the energy attacking religious liberty has gone. So during a Democratic administration, you tend to see a lot of activists sitting on the sidelines and cheering on the federal administrative state. But now they're back in the game. And you saw this happen immediately after the election. So just weeks after the election in early December of 2016, there were more than 500 activists that got together in D.C. that were planning on what they were going to do in the wake of the Trump election. And the common theme was that they were going to redirect their efforts to the state and local level. And so they were going to get back in the game. They were going to look for how to pass state laws, go to state civil rights commissions and push things through. And then they were going to be litigating. The first Women's March, which came around Trump's inauguration, the ACLU raised $24 million online over a single weekend. And that's six times what they had collected in online donations in the whole previous year. Pretty remarkable figure. And the ACLU uses that sort of money to launch lawsuits that they want to bully people into falling in line with their agenda. And so it's been a real respite at the federal level. And I think particularly the appointment of good judges. There are still plenty of things that frighten me and that I see on the horizon. Certainly, if you look at the Me Too movement, if you look at what's been going on the last few weeks with Larry Nassar, with the Olympic Committee, and with Michigan State University, with transgender activism. A friend of mine, Ryan Anderson with the Heritage Foundation, has just got a book out that's coming out in another week about that. And you see all this attention with Jordan Peterson, the psychologist out of Toronto. There continues to be this huge amount of sort of culture war battles and all these sorts of fronts, and that energy is not abating. And so certainly the Trump victory did not cause these activists to fall back in their heels and sort of say, well, we're just going to be glum and sit back, you know. So they're continuing to push. And so all those pressures are really important for religious institutions and for religious individuals.
You had mentioned to me in an earlier conversation a couple weeks back about some of the work that you're doing with groups and with groups of religious organizations. Why is it important, or how have you found it important to gather, you know, kind of the groups who are like-minded as they try to promote and protect, you know, these religious liberties?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of what I do, I do a lot of litigation in my practice, but I also do sort of a rising out of that litigation. I've done a lot of what really feels more like consulting. Yeah, any lawyer, any litigator who gets called into a situation and, you know, an employer has a discrimination claim filed against them, or, you know, there's some sort of a workers' comp claim, or there's some sort of, the lawyer gets called in, and the first thing you have to do is sort of collect, well, what have you been doing? What did you say? What are the documents that you have out there? What are your policies? You're trying to figure out, you know, what is it that I have to fix? How bad is it? And just like a primary care physician would like you to start, you know, exercising more instead of just treating you after you have a heart attack or a stroke. The same thing, you know, in my shoes is, I think because of my religious liberty work, I really want to build relationships and partner with religious institutions and say, look, there's a lot you can do now before something comes and hits you, you know, some sort of a lawsuit or some sort of an embarrassing incident, either within your community or publicly. There's a lot you can do to prepare for that and stem off that damage. And so that's a lot of what I do. Is work with you know, religious schools, religious colleges, churches, institutions of various sizes, just to kind of sit down and take a look at where are you now, what's going on in your community, what are the things that I see coming down the pipe, and what can be done to prepare to avoid certain issues and to make sure that if certain issues come your way, that you're best prepared. So that's something that I think is really helpful to do on an individual basis, and then also to do just by bringing various religious groups together and to talk, you know, conferences of Christian schools and to sort of put these issues out on the table and to talk about them. I find it immensely helpful. And so I've put together a series of steps, something that I call a mission audit, to take religious institutions through. And I published a paper on this with the Heritage Foundation about a year and a half ago. But it's a series of steps that is largely the same process that I take clients through when I work through on an individual process. But as you know, as I've sort of said, but just, you know, look at what's going on out there in the world. You can figure out where things are and where things are going. And, you know, these things are in the news every day, and, you know, putting your head down in the sand or, you know, crossing your fingers and hoping that these problems won't come and sit on your doorstep just isn't really a strategy. And so as a matter of really good stewardship, I really encourage schools and ministries to really think through where they are, what they really need in order to fulfill their God-given mission, and you know, take steps in order to protect themselves.
So when you do that mission audit, and when you go through that with, as you consult with these groups or organizations, like how might you know, schools, colleges, religious, and nature, how are they seen different than churches per se, and mm-hmm. especially in the context that I work in quite a bit, how are they seen different than even like church run schools?
Right. The most important thing that independent Christian schools need to realize is that it's harder for them to qualify for exemptions. So there's all sorts of different exemptions out there. They're all written differently. But there are several that simply will apply to a church. You know, for example, when Obama put out his HHS mandate, you know, all these years ago, they created an exemption for religious employers. But then they defined that so that a religious employer was only a church or an institution that was integrated with a church. And so that left a lot of Christian schools and Christian colleges out. You know, you and I, Eric, you know, we both went to Wheaton College, and it's remarkable that anyone could look at Wheaton and say, well, that's not a Christian institution. But that's the way this law was written, and the way that a lot of other laws are written too, that if you're not subordinate to a church, if you're not intimately connected up with a church, then you're just out. And so that's the first sort of thing, is you have to keep an eye out for laws and regulations like that. But even beyond that, even if you have something, you know, a law or regulation or some sort of an exemption that extends to religious institutions, more broadly, a church is going to have a much easier time of qualifying for that. You know, no one's going to question that a school that is physically and organizationally attached to a church is going to qualify. But an independent school just needs to do a little more work. There's, you know, this goes back decades, but there used to be, and still are, a lot of, you know, vaguely Christian, say, Episcopal schools and things like that. And when people were crafting these laws back in the 60s, they sort of thought, well, you know, the fact that some college or some prep school might be able to claim some sort of vague attachment to some religious tradition in their past, that's really, we don't want those people to get the exemption. So they started to try to figure out language and categories that would exclude those types of schools, people that had some sort of historic connection, but still have an exemption for other types of religious institutions. And whenever bureaucrats or legislators try to do that, you know, they could very well be well-intentioned, but that just doesn't turn out very well. And it doesn't always fit with reality on the ground. And so when you have an independent school, you have to really be aware of how laws and regulations are set up and what are the factors that they're looking for, so that even if you don't think that anyone within your community is confused as to whether you're a religious school, you need to make sure that you're checking the right boxes for the way that the laws and regulations that apply to you are written. So that's the first thing, is making sure you're positioned to qualify legally as a religious organization. The second thing that I find is harder for independent schools is where they don't have a strong denominational tradition to climb onto when they're trying to define who they are and what they believe. It's really hard for an individual school to try to come up with, say, a definition of marriage, or to come up with a list of, you know, a code of conduct that they want their students to follow, and to define these really dense theological terms. It's much easier for a school that is part of a strong, it is attached to a church that has thought these things through, or that is attached to a strong denomination, where they can just sort of say, look, we believe what the church that we are associated with, or the denomination or the religious tradition we're associated with, we believe what they believe. And it's much easier for a school to just say, look, if you have any questions about this, here's the higher authority. And we're not going to try to tease all those things out. But it's a harder thing. It's another step for schools to think through, because unfortunately, you know, in the last 10 years or so, terms that used to be able to do a lot of work, terms like biblical marriage, biblical morality, these things just don't really have nearly enough content anymore. And that's just the reality. That's just the pastoral reality of what's going on in our culture and even within, you know, Christian communities today. And so that's the second hurdle that independent schools have to deal with, is how are they going to best communicate and identify themselves and make clear their convictions and their standards to other people when the terms that Christians have generally relied on just aren't as useful as they used to be anymore.
So then when you think about that, the difficulty, you know, of just even the commonality of language and the commonality of just even thought and practice is like, so what, you know, so if a leader is going to, if a school leader is going to go through a process of a mission audit, like what are your key suggestions? Like what would be the things that you would say, hey, do this now here within the next year? To protect, you know, and to build up and to promote and to continue to develop the religious nature of your institution.
So I think the first thing is to do it now. So things are not great now, but there's certainly, there's less stress, less sort of immediate panic in leaders of religious schools and religious institutions than there was at this point 2 years ago. But that's an opportunity. It's not an opportunity to sit back and relax, but, you know, just like in a war, you know, if, you know, things, you're at sort of a relatively peaceful moment, you're not currently under attack. Well, now is the time to sort of assess, you know, what damage you've incurred, what, you know, where you are, you know, do you retrain your soldiers on some different things? What do you drill on? So this is, you know, the peace that we have right now, to the extent we have any, is a temporary peace. I think everybody knows that. These problems are not going away. And so now is the opportunity to, you know, maybe exhale a little bit and then gather yourself and sort of say, okay, where are we? And, you know, prudently, we think these things are still going to come down the pipe. There's no reason to think they won't. And so now is the time to prepare. But then beyond that, oftentimes, you know, when I talk to leaders, they'll say, well, what should our policies be? And I have to turn that back to them because I'm just a lawyer. And so the first part in the process is always, I'm always directing the leadership of a school or another institution to sit down and say, hey, look, get your leadership around the table. If you haven't done this, you've got to sit down and prayerfully and thoughtfully think through, who are you called to be? There's all sorts of legitimate ways to approach being a Christian school. You know, you can be one where you say every single teacher, every administrator, every employee down to a janitor has to be a Bible-believing Christian and has to, you know, sign on to these sorts of creeds. Maybe they all have to be members of your church. And then every parent and every student has to, you know, follow the same standards. Maybe that's the way you want to cast your school. If you do that, but if some people want to do that, that's all right. Most people are somewhere else where they have a mix of different standards for different sorts of employees and what they expect for parents and what they expect for students. And maybe it's parents and students of different ages, children, it changes. But that's something that, you know, I can help walk a school through those questions. Like, what are the questions we need to be thinking through? But those answers need to come through the school. They can't come from me. And so that's the first thing, is that the school really needs to have clarity in terms of what it's called to be and how it's called to serve the people in its community. Once that's done, then we can get going on the hard work. And so at that point, then the process, the real interactive process, where I think I have more to contribute, is saying, okay, well, practically speaking, what do we need in order to accomplish that mission? What does this school need? What does it need from its students? What does it need from parents? What does it need from teachers, administrators? What sort of standards do you want to have when they come into your community? What sort of standards are you going to have for them while they're a part of your community? What are you going to do if there's a certain type of infractions? How do you want to approach these sorts of things? And so getting a clear mind on that, and then it's putting those out into policies and then going through, and it's everything from corporate documents, handbooks, policies, employment notices, job descriptions, parental notices. Are you going to have parents sign something that sort of says, I understand this is the sort of community, I understand this is the sort of rules that you know, I and my my child will be held to as part of this community. Employee evaluations, employee self-evaluations, employee contracts in a school setting. That's something that you have in a school setting that you don't have in, you know, most other employment situations, is you tend to have, you know, often annual contracts. And then going through all these sorts of things and making sure they're consistent, and making sure that the school is really, you know, the bottom line is effectively communicating who it is and what that means to individual members in the community, making sure it's communicating that clearly and pastorally, and in an intelligent and a smart legal way within the community and outside the community, making sure that people understand what's expected of them and what sort of a community they're glomming onto. A lot of these lawsuits that you see, where, you know, someone gets divorced or someone has an abortion and they're asked to leave a school, for example. Oftentimes, usually what you see is the teacher claiming some sort of an ignorance, some sort of like, I was caught by surprise by this. No one had communicated this to me before. And so that's a really common pushback that you see disgruntled employees having. And the second one is, I'm being treated unfairly. So those are the two main narratives. And so to say, like, you know, I was treated this way, but somebody else was treated another way. There was a case in Fort Wayne, Indiana, a couple years ago at a Catholic school. And a teacher was let go for going through in vitro fertilization, which is against Catholic teaching. And this female teacher, a very sympathetic young woman who was just trying to get pregnant after all, and here's the mean Catholic church. And furthermore, she was able to show that another male teacher had gone to a strip club for his birthday with some colleagues, and those male teachers had just gotten a slap on the wrist. What happened was, you'll appreciate this. So they ended up going to see the head pastor, and they sat in the head pastor's office for about 10 minutes and mainly talked about baseball. And then a copy of the handbook was put in these teachers' mailboxes, and that was the end of it. And that's the sort of circumstance that, you know, there's no legal test that relates to, but it's a real powerful sort of human gut level thing. And when that gets before a jury, juries get mad about stuff like that. And that school was socked for $1.5 million after this incident. And it was a situation where this woman had clearly violated Catholic teaching. She knew it. She did it. She was told what the consequences were going to be, but because the school had arguably acted inconsistently, that was something that really, really hurt them before a judge and jury. And so making sure that you're effectively communicating these things so people can't say that they were caught off guard by these rules, and making sure that you've set up procedures in place to really make sure that everyone's on the same page and that you're doing a good job of treating employees fairly and even-handedly and consistently, that goes a long way to helping schools avoid bad feelings and then also bad litigation over these issues.
So let me ask you maybe one last question here on the legal parameters and the legal side of things, because you brought up the transgender activism, transgender issues earlier, and I think this is a difficult one for schools in general, but it's a difficult mm-hmm. one for religious schools in particular. I know there's a couple cases out there in regards to schools that don't necessarily, don't allow for cross-gender bathroom usage or locker room usage. What are you seeing in regards to the larger litigation in regards to some of these transgender issues when it comes to schools in particular, but then religious institutions in general?
Mm-hmm. I really don't think that, I mean, the law is still, there's such a battle going on right now. I don't think we really know where this is going to get settled down. The Obama administration was pushing really hard under Title IX to force schools in line. Title IX is this civil rights law that goes back to the early 70s. And, you know, I don't think, you know, nobody thinks that law would have been passed by Congress if someone would have clarified and said, oh, yeah, and by this way, this means that transgender males get to go into female locker rooms and bathrooms. There's no way that would have passed. There's no way that would pass today in Congress. all the same, that's the way it was interpreted by the Department of Education under Obama, and they pushed that really aggressively. And so the Department of Education's position was that it was even inadequate for a school to construct additional single stall bathrooms and designate those for any gender nonconforming students. That was considered to also be verboten because that's still stigmatizing transgender students. And that is a Title IX interpretation. And most Christian schools, at least, you know, primary and secondary schools, say, well, it doesn't apply to us, but it often does. And this is an important thing for religious schools to keep track of. It's not just federal, it's not just public schools. And it's not, so religious colleges and universities get sacked into Title IX because they participate within the federal student loan programs. That's an indirect way of receiving student federal funds, but then also primary and secondary schools. It's lunch programs, or it's other types of financial aid, or you know, direct aid to students, poor students, and or it could be receiving money for computer labs and things like that. When you get government money to do things like that, that will trigger Title IX. It doesn't take very much money in order to do it, and so that's one thing. Are we exposed to Title IX violations because of the streams of revenue we've agreed to receive from the government? Beyond that, the issues for religious schools on this issue will tend to come up in the context of extracurricular activities. And so, you know, the state athletic association especially for high schools will set up rules in terms of most states have already set up rules on what happens when you have a transgender athlete. And so, you know, even if you're controlling what's happening within your own school population, you still have to figure out, well, what if there's a, you know, a chess team that's visiting from another school or a basketball team or something like that? You know, what are the rules that are incumbent upon us, and then what are we going to do in that situation? So those are some difficult things. Those are things that have been happening relatively recently in the law. And so there's not a lot of clear paths. There's not a lot of clear, we just haven't seen a lot of, you know, here's a Christian school standing up for its convictions, and here's what they've done, and here's what the fallout's been. There are leaders in ACSI and elsewhere, Christian colleges, they're talking about, do we need to start setting up a separate league outside of the normal channels at the state level or at the collegiate level, you know, apart from the NCAA? Those conversations are ongoing, but those are sort of real risks. And that's just sort of a larger issue that the pressures and the restraints that come on schools, they can come directly from government, but they can also come indirectly through licensing groups or, you know, through sports leagues and things like that. And so these semi-private, semi-governmental organizations can also be a source of restraints on school. So just there's a lot of things that are coming from different areas. And I should say that the Department of Education under Trump has rescinded the interpretation, that really aggressive interpretation of Title IX, which required transgender access to bathrooms and stuff. And so the Department of Education has backed off a bit, but there's still a lot of litigation ongoing at a lot of different levels. And so these arguments and, you know, and it's not just the law, it's also just publicly, like, what's fair, what's required. You know, these conversations are just ongoing, and it's going to be complicated for a while.
Eric, I really appreciate your time and expertise. I mean, just even listening to you talk about this brings up so many other questions for me, but I know our time is limited, but probably last question and hopeful, maybe spring training starts. What do you think about the Cubs and the chances at another World Series?
Oh boy, I'd sure love to say that they're the favorites, but you know, one thing that I think, you know, anyone who loves baseball is—it's an amazing just how many free agents there still are out there right now. You know, mainly a lot of high-profile starting pitchers, but you know, there's a lot of things that just haven't settled into place. The Cubs had an easy walk through the Central Division last year. They stumbled through the first half of the season, and they've had very little trouble catching back up. But Cardinals are going to be much more competitive. I think the Brewers are going to be more competitive, and so you can't take anything for granted. So there's no World Series hangover excuse that they can grab onto this time. But I think that's what makes baseball so much fun. And I think it's going to be really competitive. There's a lot of good teams out there, and I think the regular season is going to matter a whole lot. So it's going to be fun.
It is fun. I love talking the law with you. I love talking about these things, and I love talking baseball with you too, buddy. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, man. It's been a lot of fun.